Welcome back to Making Waves. We now bring you Michael Parenti for Radio Truth with Support Our Troops.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
Support our troops, cut their benefits. If patriotism means supporting our troops, as the people in the White House keep telling us, then no one's more hypocritical, no one's more lacking in patriotism than our present rulers. In 2003-04, hundreds of U.S. troops who had been wounded in Iraq were warehoused for months at places like Fort Stewart, Georgia, in hot, dirty, overcrowded cement barracks, waiting for medical treatment. They had to hobble across the sand to use the bathroom and had to pay for their toilet paper. And only after protests from the U.S. Senate did the White House stop charging wounded soldiers $8 a day for their hospital meals. Many of the badly wounded reported that they were seeing their pay and health benefits severely reduced now that they were no longer fit for active duty. You see, once you're no longer useful to the empire treats you like it treats anyone else, just as garbage. More than 200,000 veterans of earlier wars have had to wait 6 months or longer for their first appointment with the Veterans Administration. Thousands have waited years to get into overcrowded and understaffed VA hospitals to receive disability assistance, often unable to pay their own living expenses in civilian life. It's not surprising that such a large portion of the homeless vets of past wars need help, and some of them are with serious mental and physical disabilities. In February 2002, at the very time he was sending thousands of troops to fight in Afghanistan, George W. Bush proposed tripling the cost of medications to needy veterans. In 2003, his administration announced it was cutting off access to its health care system for approximately 164,000 veterans, and it was slicing out $1.5 billion in military housing and medical facility funding. In his 2004 budget, Bush slashed $2 billion from the VA's already insufficient funds. The Bush administration even ordered officials to stop publicizing health benefits available to veterans. While praising the National Guard and reservists for serving in Iraq, George Bush opposed a proposal to allow them access to the Pentagon's health insurance system. One of the things that the money bags in the White House and their friends in corporate America like about war is its huge financial cost. The more taxpayers' money spent on war contracts, the more plentiful are the profits. Many supplies and services, including those relating to food and housing, things that were traditionally performed by soldiers, have been handed over to private contractors such as Kellogg, Brown, and Root, a Halliburton subsidiary. The result now is that U.S. troops in Iraq endured months of poor living conditions, awful food, and low-performing equipment. In 2003, a report by the Congressional Budget Office revealed that only about $2.5 billion of the $4 billion expended monthly on the Iraq War could be accounted for by the White House and the Pentagon. President Bush hypocritically heaps praise upon our men and women serving in Iraq. The truth is, he's doing everything he can to undermine them at home. So while we may continue to oppose the Iraq War and any such wars against other countries, we also should show regard for the human beings who are being used and abused in this war by the White House. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org. The music was Flute Medicine by Synth.
Jim and John are my cousin, had no place to go. There ain't nobody high around here. mine, a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now and he's still here, chasing ghosts and thin dry air. We were back at home, the finance company took his car. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
That was Steve Earle with Rich Man's War. We now bring you this interview from Tuesday, June 13th by Radio Free Santa Cruz about the evictions at the South Central LA farm, where an estimated 45 people were arrested who were trying to keep this 14-acre farm for the people of South Central LA.
All right, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. We have Leslie on the air from Los Angeles, California. Leslie, you there?
Yeah, yeah. I'm here.
Hey, what's going on in South Central?
Hi. Well, right now we're on the tail end of a really horrible and depressing forced eviction by the Sheriff's Department. We've been fundraising for 3 weeks and staging a nonviolent, peaceful protest on site in conjunction with the 350 farmer families to save this 14-acre farm of organic produce in the middle of the fifth forest region of Los Angeles. Julia Butterfly Hill was really sort of the capstone. She brought in John Quigley and Daryl Hannah, who, as an actress, has blown all of our minds, because not only did she stay day in and day out, she locked down on the walnut tree. Daryl Hannah was the last person to be taken off the property.
How many people were arrested?
30 people were arrested. And let's see, 30 people were arrested outside and 15 were arrested inside.
And this is in South Central Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, this is in the middle of a concrete wasteland of pollution and trains, and although I love trains, a lot of crime. This is where the Crips, it's a gang warfare zone, basically, and really beautiful families and people live here, and they're just torn apart by poverty and lack of economic possibilities. And this farm gave 350 families the ability to not only eat healthier and attain the dignity of bringing food to the table instead of being on welfare, it also reduced the crime rate in South Central by 70%. 70% since it first started 14 years ago. It's a significant landmark in the city for so many reasons. There's no way this thing should not have been saved. And basically the developer, who's the owner, has decided that he does not want to sell it to us, even though we raised the money last week, and he wants the farmers out of there no matter what. And it was really disturbing, and everybody was crying, and people were getting taken out on stretchers, and I don't know the extent of if people were physically hurt by the police, but they were being taken away in ambulances. I've been on the outside coordinating all of the media, and we had every major network here. They finally got Daryl and John out of the tree with a hook and ladder, with the fire station, and then I do know that CNN went live with Daryl somehow, God knows how. They got on the ground with her before she went to jail and interviewed her. So she's going to be on CNN at some point today. But it's just sad. I mean, not only are they taking us off the land, which is understandable in the sense that it is his land right now. We're fighting the sale of the land in Superior Court on July 12th, because the the sale of this land back to the developer by the city was never released to the public or offered to the farmers. It was a backroom deal, and we're hoping we might be able to win the farm that way and just pay the city. But we were told that six bulldozers went into the farm and started to tear it apart, which is just vindictive. It's not necessary. And I've been on the farm for 3 weeks. I just came on board at John Quigley's request, and I'm friends with Julia Butterfly, just to show up for a day and see what I needed to do to help it happen, and I literally never left. I've been here for 3 weeks. It's a gorgeous oasis. Every single race has been, every nationality, not national, every race has been here to save the farm. We've had to learn in a 14-acre property how to basically have world peace. I mean, we're the microcosm of the macrocosm, and we had people that were really poor and in gangs seeing me come in with my titanium Macintosh laptop computer, and we had to work out any prejudices or any perceptions of difference, and it's been the most amazing experience. We're all like family and brothers and sisters now, and we love each other, and we're not gonna let this stop us. We're gonna keep fighting for the farm, and it's all over the news. It should be all over the internet. If people want to log on and get some pictures, they've got all kinds of crazy pictures. And you can also go to southcentralfarmers.com to get updated information, action alerts. I do know the NRDC sent out a South Central Farm action alert yesterday, which is exciting. Just the awareness is growing, and the stories actually have been within the first 4 days of our tree sit beginning. The story of South Central Farm as the nation's largest urban farm being sold to a developer to build warehouses was carried in 20 countries by over 200 media outlets. So clearly, this is a world issue, and people are getting more concerned about global warming and economic justice and the idea of growing our food inside our own city walls so that we're not trucking it all over the country and using fossil fuels to get it. You know, why not tear the warehouses down and create beautiful farms where people can convene and play music and tell stories? And one of the first things I heard from the farmers was this is a place where children can hang out with their grandparents and learn the traditional ways. And it just brought tears to my eyes because it's kind of something we've all moved away from that I feel like the human spirit really needs again, is a place of community and to come together and to be in community. And there's just so much magic on the South Central Farm that it feels like we have angels watching over us, and that we really hope this is going to go through somehow. Even though we've been evicted, we're not giving up. And what else can I tell you?
So this
Julia stayed till the last minute, and she didn't eat for 26 days.
This is a 14.
Yeah, we have a pretty high level of commitment going on down here.
This is a 14-acre farm in South Central Los Angeles. And there's so far been 45 arrests, is that right? Around
correct.
That's what I'm reading off of LA Indy Media right now.
That's correct.
As of today, Tuesday, June 13th, 2006. Sheriffs will allow the farmers to return within 15 days to claim property they left on the farm.
Oh, good. I left my digital camera there with all my pictures of Willie Nelson.
So what's going on right now? Are you, like, are there riot cops keeping you out, or what?
Sorry, go ahead.
Are there riot cops keeping you guys out?
We're not going to be allowed on the property. There were probably 200 officers deployed to remove 30 people. Some of the extra arrests that I mentioned were actually people on the outside who came down to downtown L.A. And just jumped in and said, I want to stop this. I want to get involved. So we had spontaneous arrests that were happening. People made chains and linked hands across Alameda Street, which is a six-lane major artery in Los Angeles. They just sat down and blocked traffic. And it's just, I mean, it's heartening. It just brings tears to your eyes how committed people are. And I feel like urban farming is a concept that it's new and it needs to happen. And both Julia Butterfly and I think we shared a very similar passion about this farm because we see it as a establishing a precedent for all of our nation's cities to start growing local, eating local, having green space, and the other extension of the farm is if we save it, part of the plan is to take a small portion of one of the corners and build a solar-powered, green-built community center so that the people have somewhere to go. Because right now there's nowhere safe for the children to play in all of South Central. There's just the parks are filled with drug transactions, and it's really dangerous. So, you know, it's not even a farm, just a farm. It's going to be a green-built community center.
Yeah.
And that was the farmer's own idea. That was not something that we laid on them. By the time we showed up to participate, they already had their complete sustainable plan. And one of the principles that Julia brought up was, you know, how else are people that are below poverty going to get fresh organic food for their children and start turning back the death march of overweight children and diabetes? And, you know, there's a lot of unhealthy poor people around, and this could be a way to bring them back on the chart. So, do you have any questions?
Yeah, what can folks do to support what's going on there?
What folks can do is there's a few things. There's a councilwoman named Jan Perry who is completely blocking the farm being saved for her own reasons. And so to write a letter to Jan Perry, it's very simple. You can go on SouthCentralFarmers.com. Click on the link to write a letter to Jan Perry. In addition, it'd be nice to write to the mayor as well and just tell him that it's appalling what happened, and he really needs to stand by his word of taking care of the Spanish-speaking contingency that brought him into office. He could have blocked this, although he is subject to the law. We feel like he could have done more to give us more time to cut the deal.
Right.
You know, and then the other thing people can do is we're still collecting donations online. Even a dollar helps. We've raised $70,000 from people just making small donations, and it's all going to the pot to finalize the deal. We have a big portion of the money already as a gift from the Annenberg Foundation, which has decided that it wants to invest in the greening of L.A., again, as a precedent for the nation's deeply urban areas to start creating more livable environments for people. I think it's really exciting. And we're going to City Hall today to continue the protest, and I would say just keep in your mind thoughts or prayers or what have you for the highest resolution to come for not only South Central Farm but the people of LA, because the farm is in the heart of Los Angeles, and I believe that because we have such worldwide media attention now that the saving of this farm could be a really a marked keynote on the calendar of kind of moving back into a little more balanced living with the earth and more green consciousness in our lifestyle.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you. This is Leslie Morava. Is that right?
Morava.
Thanks
for getting us online, and save the farm.
Thank you very much for
talking
with us. Take
care.
You
got it.
All right.
If you want to update, just check online, and feel free to call me back at any time.
Okay, southcentralfarmers.com, right?
Exactly.
All right.
And we also have .org. They're slightly different sites with different information, but they're both official.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Santa Cruz.
All right.
We love you.
All right, we love you too. Take care. All right, that was Leslie Morava from southcentralfarmers.com.
That report was from Tuesday, June 13th. Here we have an update from the South Central Farmers. As you all know, it's been a difficult week at the farm. This past Tuesday, June 13th, at 5 a.m., a squadron of approximately 300 officers from the Sheriff's Department and LAPD physically evicted the farmers and their supporters from the farm. approximately 44 people were arrested or detained. The scene turned distressful as small bulldozers were brought in to create access for fire trucks and then took a joyride through the farm, carving a path of destruction. As horrific and painful as it was to witness, and as it is to see the farm now after the fact, it is still intact. It has not been leveled. And as long as we as a community remain together, we can take back the farm. On July 12th, we will be in court for the first hearing regarding the lawsuit challenging the legality of the 2003 property sale to Mr. Horowitz by the City of Los Angeles. Until the hearing, and hopefully through the duration of this process, we will be continuing our 24-hour watch at the farm to prevent any further destruction. There is still the threat of earth movers coming to clear the farm of its plants and trees. Standing in unity, with the utmost dignity and always respecting the law, we can still save the farm. This struggle has been ongoing for 3 years. In respect to other environmental justice and social justice movements, we are still young. We have not lost.
Well, paper cups are fun and plastic corks are cool. I like to be on the move when I eat my gruel. Don't get me wrong, disposable diapers are really great. But my favorite feature of these United States are parking lots and strip malls. Parking lots and strip malls. Get rid of those trees lit in the light of day. And those condos spread out so far and wide. But nothing beats parking lots, strip malls, and the ocean tide. Parking lots and strip malls. Parking lots and strip malls. The world needs more parking lots and strip malls. Stuff. And I go to the Cineplex when life is getting rough. Driving down the highways, Mickey D's is where I get my rest. But parking lots and strip malls is the place that I love best. Parking lots and strip malls. Parking lots and strip malls. The world needs more parking lots and strip malls. Parking lots and strip malls. Parking lots and strip malls. The world needs more parking lots and strip malls.
That was David Rovics with Parking Lots and Strip Malls. You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present retired Brigadier General and psychiatrist Stephen Zanakis, who discusses the conditions at the U.S. military's detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, that contributed to the suicides of three detainees held there without charge or trial. Journalist and author Aaron Glantz, who looks at the killing of the Jordanian terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and the impact his death may have on the Iraq War. And Len Berman, director of the Tax Policy Center, who assesses the winners and losers in the tax cuts promoted by the Bush administration and the Republican-controlled Congress. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a new report, Human Rights Watch says rape victims in Mexico face a second assault when local officials deny their right to a safe and legal abortion. Abortion is illegal in Mexico and most of Latin America. However, rape victims in Mexico do have the right to a legal and safe abortion. As the 92-page Human Rights Report shows, exercising that right is difficult. Public agencies, including the State Attorney General's Office, public hospitals, and family service agencies, discourage rape victims from seeking an abortion. For example, a 13-year-old girl who was raped by a family member was shown a misleading anti-abortion video to convince her not to use her reproductive rights. In other cases, prosecutors have threatened rape victims with jail time if they sought an abortion. As Human Rights Executive Director Kenneth Roth declared, the Mexican government needs to ensure that rape victims do not have to endure back-alley abortions or imposed pregnancies. The right to an abortion has emerged as an issue in Mexico's tight presidential election campaign. Felipe de Jesus Calderón Hinojosa of the ruling conservative National Action Party is opposed to any effort to liberalize Mexico's abortion laws. In contrast, the party of the Democratic Revolution's Andrés Manuel López Obrador, former mayor of Mexico City, wants the future of abortion rights to be decided in a public referendum. The election is scheduled for July 2nd. The government estimates 120,000 Mexican women and girls are raped each year. Advocates for rape victims say women have few legal rights. Until last fall, the Mexican Supreme Court ruled that it was not necessarily a criminal offense when a husband raped his wife. The 20-year ban on commercial whaling is in danger as the International Whaling Commission, or IWC, meets in mid-June on the Caribbean islands of St. Kitts and Nevis. For the first time since the moratorium was imposed in 1986 due to international outcry, the pro-whaling member nations of the IWC, Japan, Norway, and Iceland, expect to have the support of the majority of the Commission's member nations. The IWC was founded in the 1940s to regulate whaling nations. Today, a few thousand whales are killed each year for so-called scientific purposes, although environmental critics say most of the whale meat ends up in Japanese restaurants. While the whaling ban would probably not be revoked immediately, a majority vote on the IWC could disband the Conservation Committee and restrict oversight of Japan's scientific whaling program. According to the Guardian newspaper, Japan has made a series of multi-million dollar development deals with poor Pacific Island nations like Nauru and Kiribati, who now sit on the Whaling Commission. Before the 1986 ban, more than 2 million whales were killed. In recent years, populations of minke whales have increased in the Antarctic and North Atlantic. Still, the population of humpback whales in the Pacific remains low. Marine conservationists fear a return to a slaughter of whales. As Leah Garces of the World Society for the Protection of Animals observed, we could go back to the 1970s, when whales were unprotected throughout the world. Federal Judge Robert Pratt has ruled that a state-funded Bible-centered program in an Iowa prison run by Chuck Colson's Prison Fellowship Ministries is unconstitutional. The district court ruling in response to a lawsuit from Americans United for Separation of Church and State is a blow to efforts to use government funds for evangelical programs, especially in prisons. Judge Pratt ordered the state of Iowa to disband the program in 60 days. He also ordered the Prison Fellowship Ministries to return $1.53 million in state funds. The ruling is expected to be appealed. Prison Fellowship Ministries President Mark Early called the ruling extreme and bizarre. Reverend Barry Lynn, head of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, praised the decision. As Lynn told the Washington Post, "In the distance, one can hear the bells tolling deep trouble for the faith-based initiative." Legal experts expect the case to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and its fate could be decided by the new conservative justices, John Roberts and Sam Alito. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Three detainees at the U.S. Navy's detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were found dead in their cells June 10th after hanging themselves with clothes and bedsheets. Two of the men who killed themselves were from Saudi Arabia and one was from Yemen. About 460 people, many of them captured in Afghanistan, have been imprisoned at the Pentagon-run facility, some for as long as 4.5 years. Only 10 of the prisoners there have been charged with crimes, while the remaining detainees have been held without charges or trials. The Pentagon admits that there had been 41 suicide attempts by 25 detainees at Guantanamo, and as many as 89 inmates have participated in hunger strikes this year. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Public Diplomacy Colleen Graffy commented that the suicides were, quote, a good PR move, while Rear Admiral Harry Harris, Guantanamo's commander, characterized the inmates' deaths as, quote, asymmetric warfare. The three suicides have renewed calls for the closure of the Guantanamo facility. The United Nations Commission on Human Rights, European governments, and religious denominations are among the international groups that have demanded that the prison be closed. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with retired Brigadier General and psychiatrist Stephen Zanakis, a spokesperson with Physicians for Human Rights, who discusses the conditions at the Guantanamo Detention Center that contributed to the suicides of three detainees.
Well, what I've heard of the conditions, and not very many people have been allowed to visit, is that for the individual detainees, they're finding the environment that they're in increasingly more depressing for them, and they're feeling more hopeless and very helpless of what might be the outcomes. They certainly have the basics, you know, food, water, clothing, and all that. But many of them are housed in individual cells. The communication that they have with each other is limited. And over time, depending on what's happening, the freedom that they have in terms of what they do is more and more restricted. So for these people who have been there now 4.5 years, they're finding that it's getting tougher and tougher.
Dr. Zanakis, speak to us a bit about international law. The Bush administration seems to say it's exempt from international law when it comes to these detainees who they classify as enemy combatants. In your knowledge of military justice and the rules of warfare, what's your view on how these individuals are being held at Guantanamo?
My personal opinion is it is in our interest as a country to conform to international law. And I'm not speaking as a lawyer, but from the standpoint of what we're trying to say to the world, that we stand and present ourselves to the world as a nation that adheres to the highest standards, as well as ethically and legally, I think we are able to promote our position and help our position best by conforming to those laws and showing the world that we're fully accountable. And I think it really makes a real difference in the state of mind of these detainees as well.
With these three suicides at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, what does that do to the reputation of the United States, and what repercussions are there for U.S. soldiers in the field in Iraq or elsewhere around the globe?
There's been a group of general officers and flag officers, generals and admirals, who earlier this year supported the McCain Amendment vigorously and sent a letter to President Bush urging him to support the amendment, because they felt that it's very important to show the world that we are not acting in any way that could be interpreted as cruel, inhumane, or degrading, because we do not wish to further endanger the welfare of men and women serving in harm's way. These kinds of events can possibly, and I think even our senior officials are worried, these kinds of events can further endanger our soldiers who are serving in these troubled areas.
In terms of preventing future suicide attempts and hunger strikes that have, you know, characterized many of the inmates being held in Guantanamo, what would your advice be to the prison and medical officials who are controlling the situation over at Guantanamo?
Well, I think it's in our best interest to get the best medical care we can get to them. And as part of that medical care, to get the best mental health care that we can deliver. And that's not to say that the people there who are, you know, men and women that I've served with are not excellent doctors and nurses and medics. But the detainees are very skeptical because of their experiences up to this point that anybody in uniform and anybody that they can identify with the military really is going to work in their best interests and help them. So I think it would really help us to get independent teams down there to evaluate these people and help treat them.
There are some people in the country who, of course, say that the United States is in a war on terrorism and that it's okay if we treat people roughly or abuse them and even violate the Geneva Conventions. How do you respond to that viewpoint, which is certainly heard around the country?
Well, I'll tell you, from ancient times, and if you even read Greek mythology, there's been a recognition that even in war, there are ethical principles that everyone must acknowledge and conform to, and that in treating your enemy by these principles, ethically and humanely, in the end, everyone is helped and the world is a safer place. And it is in our interests to make sure that at all times we are being the fairest to our enemy and respect their dignity and their humanity.
That was retired Brigadier General and psychiatrist Stephen Zanakis, a spokesperson with Physicians for Human Rights. Contact the group by calling area code 202-728-5335 or visit their website at www.phrusa.org. A U.S. airstrike, which dropped two 500-pound bombs on a farmhouse north of Baghdad June 7th, killed Jordanian-born terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, his spiritual advisor, and four other people, including a woman and a child. Since the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003, Zarqawi, the self-declared leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, had taken credit for hundreds of suicide bombings, kidnappings, and beheadings. Before the war, the Bush administration had pointed to Zarqawi's presence in Iraq to help justify the war, although he was not in a zone controlled by Saddam Hussein. Both President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki applauded the killing of Zarqawi, but acknowledged that his demise would not end the insurgency. Zarqawi's death diverted American media attention from the investigation into charges that U.S. Marines had killed 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians in the town of Haditha last November. Amid increasing opposition among Americans to the Iraq war, President Bush flew to Baghdad on June 13th to show support for Prime Minister Maliki's newly installed government. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Aaron Glantz, who looks at the killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Haditha massacre, and the impact these events may have on the course of the Iraq war.
Well, I think the killing of Zarqawi is much less significant than the administration makes it out to be. You know, these terrorists, these foreign terrorists, they were in Iraq when I first arrived in the country shortly after the fall of Saddam Hussein. But there was no support amongst the Iraqi people for any kind of armed attacks on American soldiers at that time, and so they were not very effective. And what's happened since then is that the vast majority of Iraqi people have come to despise the occupation. And this is for very practical reasons, the lack of electricity and clean water. I mean, it's 120 degrees in Baghdad today. Imagine trying to sleep without a fan. You get grouchy. And in addition to that, you have 15,000 Iraqis in prison without trial at Abu Ghraib and other facilities run by our government. And in addition to that, you have incredible numbers of accidental killings by American forces. For example, this woman who was on the road to give birth in Samarra last week when she was shot by the U.S. military at a checkpoint, or then bigger massacres like the one at Haditha last November where U.S. Marines killed 24 Iraqis, including an elderly woman and a four-year-old boy. I mean, these are the reasons that people in Iraq attack the U.S. military. And the killing of Zarqawi, while most Iraqis are, you know, not going to shed any tears for him, is not going to be a big change in terms of what's happening overall.
Given that there are a lot of observers out there, and maybe even including yourself, who believe that Iraq is now currently in a state of civil war, death squads roam the country, people turn up dead every day, you know, with their hands tied behind their back, you know, killed execution style, just for the very branch of Islam that they adhere to. Tell us a bit about your take on Zarqawi's success at his stated goal of triggering an interethnic war.
Well, I think it would be misplaced to put all of this at the foot of Zarqawi. I mean, remember that when the U.S. military went into Iraq, one of the things they did was hire a company called Research Triangle Institute out of North Carolina, which was charged with selecting, and their slogan was selections, not elections. And they were hired by the Bush administration to pick the new Iraqi government solely based on the ethnic lines of the people in particular communities. They would come to a community center and select the local government and say, how many Sunni do we have here, how many Shia, how many Kurd, etc. And this forced the Iraqi people to organize themselves that way in order to get representation. And now the situation is getting out of control. The Bush administration would like to blame the sectarian conflict on Zarqawi, when in fact this is something that they started themselves.
And where do you think this thing is headed in terms of the horrendous carnage that we see unfolding, you know, day by day there with the death squads and, you know, what seems to be growing polarization in that country?
The U.S. presence is exacerbating this because there are some real issues that are going on between the different factions in Iraq. But what's masking it is that all of these different factions, they're all in a position where they're focusing on attacking the American occupation. And so they're reticent. Like the people who are involved in the armed resistance, the nationalist resistance against the occupation, they're reticent to take on the foreign al-Qaeda terrorists that have infiltrated the country that are broadly despised by the Iraqi people. And the reason for that is that they temporarily share the goal of ending the occupation. And, you know, if the U.S. military were to leave Iraq, then the Iraqi people would be able to begin to come together against these foreign terrorists. But as long as the occupation remains, then I think you'll see that the sectarian conflict will worsen. And it may even worsen, you know, if we leave, but it will definitely worsen if we stay.
Maybe, Aaron, you can just mention briefly what you wrote about in your story titled U.S. Military Hides Many More Hadithas, where you talk about a hospital that was shot up in violation of the Geneva Conventions.
Well, this has occurred at the same time as that massacre. What it was part of an overall raid that happened at that time where the U.S. military, much like is happening now in Ramadi, decided they want to get the terrorists in Haditha. So they sealed off the city, they cut the electricity, they cut the water, they cut the phone line so nobody could talk or communicate with anyone. Then one of the first things they did was raid the hospital. They arrested some of the doctors. They shot, actually, one of the patients. You know, this, according to the Iraqi Red Crescent Society, there were over 1,000 refugees from this military operation. And that's why I say that, you know, it's almost like trying to pick which story you want to tell, because there are just so many of them. The Iraqi ambassador to the United States, he's from Haditha, and his cousin was killed by the U.S. Marines in June of 2005, a few months before this massacre, being ripped out of his own home in one of these house-to-house raids, and then shot. And he says that after the U.S. military shot his cousin, they left the house with a smile on their face as if they had a job well done. And this is a relative of the Iraqi ambassador to the United States.
That was journalist Aaron Glantz, author of the book How America Lost Iraq. Read his articles online at www.aaronglantz.com. Last month, the U.S. Congress voted to extend until 2010 an earlier tax cut it passed at the behest of President Bush. That extension, along with postponing for 1 year the requirement for many tax filers to comply with the alternative minimum tax, amounts to a $70 billion tax cut, the vast majority of it going to the wealthiest Americans. The Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center estimates that the richest 20% of Americans will reap almost three-quarters of the benefits, while the top one-half of 1% will gain 20% of benefits from the tax cut. But the corporate media, for the most part, reported as fact conservatives' claim that this move would benefit the American economy broadly. Then last week, the Senate voted down an attempt to repeal the estate tax outright that would have cost the government up to $1 trillion in revenue over the coming decade. But Congress left intact many changes that have allowed wealthy families to avoid paying significant taxes upon the death of a wealthy head of household. The tax cuts and changes to inheritance laws have together dramatically shifted the tax burden from the wealthy to middle and working class citizens at a time when the U.S. is spending $250 million a day on the war in Iraq and facing a $400 billion deficit. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Len Berman, director of the Tax Policy Center, which is a joint project of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution, who explains who's really benefiting from the cuts and who's suffering.
What's most annoying about all the rhetoric about capital gains and dividends tax cuts, the assumption is that since capital gains are earned on company profits, that it must be a way of getting more money to companies and therefore producing more investment and economic growth. And that's not necessarily true. I mean, there are a couple of reasons why. One is that most of the capital coming into the United States now actually doesn't even come from individual investors who are affected by capital gains and dividends taxes. It comes from pension funds that are tax-free and from foreigners. And they were completely unaffected by this legislation. Second, by lowering the tax rate on capital gains and dividends, you give wealthy people a very strong incentive to try to earn income in that form, because if they earn a capital gain, it's taxed at a 15% rate, whereas if they earn regular wages and salaries, they're taxed at a 35% rate. So there's a whole industry, a tax shelter industry, that's devoted to finding ways to convert ordinary income into capital gains. So, you know, when you look at the evidence overall, the effect of cutting capital gains tax rates is as likely to slow down the economy as to make it grow, especially when you're financing it through deficits. The government's borrowing the money to encourage this new investment. And if you think about it, where does that money come from? It comes out of the same pool of funds that's financing business investment in the United States.
The U.S. is spending $250 million a day on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the government is continuing to make these huge tax cuts. And besides the ballooning deficit, budget cuts are causing real pain to middle and low-income Americans, like cuts in college loans and cuts in social programs. Why can Congress even get away with this?
I think people aren't connecting the dots, or at least there's not a majority of Americans who understand that the tax cuts we're enacting now have to be paid back with interest by our children, that you can't simultaneously be increasing spending, not only for the war, but also for, you know, a lot of spending projects, many of which are questionable, like the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska. You know, spending is out of control, and we're cutting taxes and ballooning the national debt. And it's at the worst possible time. We know that in a few years, the baby boomers are going to start to retire, and the demands on the U.S. government are going to be immense, that we're going to need to raise a lot of revenue just to pay for the promises that we've already made to America's older workers. You know, on top of that, accumulating additional debt just seems ridiculously foolhardy.
Len Berman, do you think if the Democrats recapture one or both houses of Congress in the fall, that that would make a difference in some of these votes that seem so egregiously contrary to the interests of the vast majority of Americans?
One would hope. The last presidential election wasn't really encouraging. Presidential candidate Kerry actually would have increased the deficit by as much as President Bush promised to do. He just would have done it in a different way, maybe without so much of the benefits going to the very wealthy.
There have been major changes to the estate tax over the past few years, which allow wealthy families to keep much more of their wealth. Last week, the Senate tried and failed to get rid of the tax altogether. There are a lot of myths about this tax, like it would hurt small family farmers is one that's heard a lot.
The estate tax is the most progressive tax in the whole federal system. It only applies to the wealthiest, at this point, wealthiest one-half of 1% of decedents. That is 5 in 1,000 people who die. And actually, even if they just let it go back to where it was in 2001, so that there's $1 million exemption, it would only apply to 2% of decedents. 98% would pay no tax under the estate tax. The estate tax, it actually plays an important role in serving as a backstop to the income tax. A lot of the money in people's estates was never subject to tax under the income tax. And actually, the congressional experts who looked at this concluded that if you eliminated the estate tax, there'd be a rash of new tax shelters that rich people would use to further avoid tax on their regular income. It's an important tax just from the point of view of the integrity of the whole tax system. And people say it's a really odious tax because you pay it when you die, but it actually seems to me like a pretty good deal. You get to use the money your whole life. You can pass it tax-free to your spouse, And then if your spouse dies and has a lot of wealth left, then some of it is subject to tax under the estate tax. There's a religious element behind some of the politics in the United States. The religious metaphor that I think of is the story of Joseph, who went to Egypt and made himself somewhat famous by telling the Pharaoh that there were going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine, and suggesting that it might be a good idea to fill up the granaries during the period of plenty, because, you know, during the period of famine, otherwise his people are going to starve. So basically, we know that the famine is coming in terms of our federal budget. It's going to start when the baby boomers start retiring in 2010. And instead of filling the granaries, we're emptying them.
That was Len Berman of the Tax Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Contact the group by calling area code 202-833-7200 or visit their website at www.taxpolicycenter.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be featuring a Making Waves interview of Chris Nord about a current campaign against nuclear power in New England, and much more. We leave you with this quote by John Vasconcelos, who is a member of the California State Assembly for 30 years and a California State Senator for 8 years. Not to act is to act. To be angry and do nothing is to cede the power to somebody else, and is a political act by itself. We are always political. We might as well be constructively political and see to it that our visions of ourselves and the possibilities for our future are at the heart of the dialogue.